is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Monday, March 23rd, 2020. I'm Buster Olney in my home studio in New York, and Taylor Schwenk is producing in his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut. So I'm very excited today because we got Dave Roberts, the manager of the Dodgers, to talk to us about the most pivotal stolen base in the history of baseball, in my opinion. We taped with him the other day, Taylor. That was so much fun to hear the level of detail about that particular play from him.
Yeah, I mean, I'll continue to be impressed by all these guys who just remember every beat of these enormous moments. I mean, one of the biggest stolen base in all of baseball history, and he just is transported back immediately. I mean, he tells us all about the run up to it, how he got to the Red Sox. It was amazing. And he says he doesn't really go back and even reflect on it personally, let alone talk about it. So this is a real treat for the listeners.
Yeah, and after I finished that interview, I texted Theo Epstein, who, of course, was the general manager of the Red Sox when they made that trade. He gave me some details that I'll present later. And Sarah Langs will join us to break down the greatest stolen bases in baseball history. Before we get to all that, Blue Jays president Mark Shapiro expects that teams would need 4 weeks to prepare for a season whenever baseball gets a go to resume. The Yankees' Aaron Judge spoke with reporters the other day. He says his rib is a bit better. He also revealed that he, and this was for the first time that he talked about this, that he suffered a partially collapsed lung that he says is now healed. Also, I want to note, during this time of social isolation, no games to watch, it's not just the Baseball Tonight podcast that's coming to you every day. ESPN podcast is adapting to this new normal and churning out a ton of new content from all of your favorite shows. Last week, there were new episodes of ESPN Daily, Fantasy Focus Football, The Woj Pod, Sports with Katie Nolan, Ariel Helwani's MMA show, Stupidity, The Low Post, and Laughter Permitted with Julie Foudy. You can listen to all of these and more wherever you get your podcasts. Dave Roberts is manager of the Los Angeles Dodgers after a 10-year playing career in which he executed one of the most famous stolen bases in baseball history. Dave, how you doing?
Buster, I'm doing, great under these crazy circumstances and times.
Well, I want to ask you about that stolen base back in 2004 and the Boston comeback in the American League Championship Series. But before we get to that, how are you spending your days?
So I'm in San Diego with my family, and we're all isolating ourselves, as we all should, and doing a lot of watching of TV, kind of doing the family dinners and breakfast and lunch, I guess, going for family walks and spending time with the family. And I think, it's interesting, Buster, as we look out and things are going on around us in very scary and trying times, I think the one thing that it has done for my family, and I think a lot of families around, is it's forced us to be together, and we're really reconnecting. So we're trying to make the most of this crazy situation.
Yeah, just before I got on with you, I was playing Monopoly with my wife and my 15-year-old son. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Exactly. And my son has actually taught me how to play some poker. So my wife, my son, and my daughter, we've just been playing some poker, and it's been a lot of fun.
Well, there you go. We'll save your money.
Yeah, just chips.
There you go. All right, so I wanted to get you on, to, as we did with David Freese, to do some storytelling and take you back to 2004. At the time you were traded to the Red Sox, it was July 31st, 2004. You were 32 years old at the time, and the Red Sox already had Manny Ramirez and Johnny Damon and Gabe Kapler and Trot Nixon. They got David Ortiz as the DH, and I tried to put myself in your position at that time. Of how you felt at the time you were traded to the Red Sox.
Yeah, it's interesting is that I don't go back to that moment in time very often. I really don't. So it's actually kind of interesting. And my wife was actually 7 months pregnant with my daughter. I was with the Dodgers in first place. And, we were playing the Padres. Just got done beating them on a Friday night, I recall. So Saturday, I think that was July 31st deadline. And once it was, I think, 2 o'clock local time, my wife and I were saying, okay, we heard some rumors. And I think then we just said, man, we made it past the deadline. And I didn't want to leave anywhere. I loved Los Angeles, being with the team and, Adrian Beltre, Sean Green, all those guys. And so I got a call at 2:05 from Paul DePodesta. And he then told me that I got traded to the Red Sox. So I was devastated. I loved Boston going in there as a visiting player when I was with the Indians. But, you know, my wife pregnant. So then to now logistically try to figure that out, to move to go to Boston and finish out the year was kind of crazy. Now, funny story. So Jack McCormick is still the traveling secretary for the Red Sox. So Jack calls me and says, hey, I want to get your travel arrangements all set up, and we got you on a flight later tonight. And so I'm panicking, Buster. I'm like, I don't want to leave tonight. It's just too soon. So basically, I can tell this story now. We kind of get together to go, my wife and I, and I was going to plan for me to leave. And so we're driving, and as I'm driving to San Diego Airport, I'm saying, I am not getting on this flight. So I end up calling Jack and saying that I just can't make my flight, traffic, accident. And so he goes, okay, no problem. You don't need to meet the team in Minnesota. Stay at home, fly out the next day, and go meet us in Tampa. And so, Buster, true story, because I just needed that extra night to be with my family to then reset a little bit. And ultimately, I met the team in Tampa, and it was great.
So, boy, is it going through that, did it ever in the back of your mind, you're like, you know what, I don't know if I want to do this? Or did you just need a moment?
I just needed a moment. It was one of those things, you know, you got your wife, and I got my four-year-old son at that time, and it just, like, it was a whirlwind. And that's the thing, is that, you know, players that go through it, some that haven't gone through it, it's a crazy time. And it's not about gratitude at all, because obviously you're grateful for your job, but it's crazy. So I never contemplated not going. Obviously, that's a part of what I signed up for. But I just needed a minute to kind of catch my breath with my wife. And, you know, I remember going to the clubhouse in Tampa, and being a former teammate with Manny when I first got to the big leagues in Cleveland, he came and gave me a big hug. David Ortiz gave me a big hug when I got there. Millar gave me a big hug when I was in the Tampa clubhouse. So it was an easy transition for me. And then later on, my wife got the green light from our doctor that she could travel. And then she had to kind of stay put in Boston once she got there. So then it became easier. But that initial shock, I mean, I remember going back to Petco and getting my stuff from the clubhouse and my locker, and kind of, and being in tears, you know, in front of the media here about this trade. And, you know, we are a first place team, and you don't really see many people, three major league players that are traded at that time. I think it was Laduca, myself, and Guillermo Mota, which were all pretty good pieces to that team being traded at that time. So it was difficult.
Now, was there a part of you too? Because you mentioned the personal side of it, the professional side of it, the idea of going to a team where they have all these established outfielders, where you're kind of like, hey, what am I going to do?
Yeah, it was absolutely the case. You know, I was a starting outfielder for the Dodgers. And then I go there, and at that time, Trout was hurt. And so one thing I do appreciate is that Tito was, like, so upfront. He said, hey, I know your situation. You're having a good year. You know, Trout Nixon is hurt. He'll be back in a month. You're going to play every day, you know, while he's down. But when he comes back, you know, you're going to be our fourth outfielder and play a role for us. And it's one of those things that I really appreciate. You know, you never like hearing that news, but he was very upfront, and I just kind of embraced that role. And Trot was fantastic. Obviously, Johnny and Manny and Gabe was there. So we just had a really good team. But, yeah, I mean, selfishly, you know, you're a starter and you're playing every day, and then now you're going to be relegated to that fourth, fifth outfielder thing. It was kind of tough.
So when did you start to get into the flow of that team?
As far as the dynamic of the team, very, very quickly. We always had these things called show breakfast, where every day on the road, outside of a getaway day, it was like a 10 o'clock standing appointment where everyone would, whoever would want to go, would show up in the lobby. We'd just kind of go to breakfast. And it sometimes it was five guys, sometimes it was 15 guys, you know, and
wow,
guys would hang out. Yeah, and at the ballpark, you know, guys were hanging out, and it was just an incredible group that it was very team-oriented, individualized as far as kind of the characters of the guys. But once we got to the ballpark, the only goal was to win a baseball game. And that was really unique to me because I just never been in that market where it was just such a magnifying glass, you know, and so it was interesting, but it was such a good group. And those guys made me feel welcome, you know, from the get go.
Now, later, Johnny Damon coined the phrase idiots. You know, did that feel like kind of a, I mean, I know from afar, it did seem like a kind of a nice dirtbag type of team.
Yeah, and I think that idiot is what Johnny used, but I think nice dirtbag is what I would have probably referred to us as. I like that one, Buster.
There you go.
It was, yeah, no, but it was, you know, it was a bunch of just guys kind of crazy, you know, but I think that, you know, what's funny is that you say idiots, and I think that it was a term that Johnny used, but it was very methodical in the sense of how we use that phrase, because, you know, on the outside, it seemed like guys didn't know or didn't care. But when you know this group of guys, it was actually a very smart group of guys and managed their, whether it be their brands or really taking away the focus or the pressure of having to win and not winning in 86 years. So all that kind of what they kind of did, it was very kind of thought through.
And there was nobody who maybe embodied that better to me than Manny Ramirez, who, you know, through for the media, for fans, they thought of him as being the guy who disappeared into the Green Monster and always seemed to be a little bit flighty. But I've talked to so many of his teammates who just talked about how intense his preparation was, his understanding of pitchers.
That's right. And I think that anyone that spent any time with Manny, let alone if you're talking about baseball or hitting, he was one of the smartest guys you'll ever come across. And I think for me, Barry Bonds and Manny were the two at the top for me as far as talking, hitting, and understanding what pitchers are trying to do. And Manny had that kind of aura that he didn't care. He didn't know what was going on, didn't know what pitch he hit, didn't matter what bat he used, but he knew exactly what he was doing.
All right. You mentioned that as Trout came back and they go, the Red Sox go into the postseason. At that point, from what Tito told me, the conversation with you was, hey, just be ready. And he texted me when I told him I was going to talk to you. He said, and boy, was he ever ready when we asked. Despite the fact in the first round against the Angels, you get into one game.
Yep.
And then you did not play in games one, two, or three against the Yankees in the American League Championship Series. Before we get to game four, what was your experience like dropping into that Yankees-Red Sox rivalry, which earlier that year, before you joined the team, got really heated? They got brawls. They got all kinds of stuff going on. What were those games like?
It was really intense. And I think that, you know, me being a guy from the West Coast, you know, you see the Yankees-Red Sox, and we make jokes out on the West Coast that it's every Sunday night you're seeing Red Sox-Yankees and, you know, the hype of that series, and you hear it a lot. But I think that for me to be a part of it, and that was kind of the same year where Tech and A-Rod got into it. And I remember when I got over there, there was a Kenny Lofton situation running into, I don't know if it was Millar at first base, and
yep.
Then I got thrown at. And so I got a little piece of that. And so it was a lot of fun, you know, and the fans, the media, the players, really, there was really no love lost, but obviously mutual respect. And it just seemed like, I mean, I played in game sevens and managed in game sevens, and not to say that every game was a game seven, because I've lived it and it's not, but I will say that every time Yankees Red Sox go on, it seems like every game is do or die. So it was great for me to be a part of. I think that when I can look back and say I was a part of that and got to play the Yankees in Yankee Stadium as a Red Sox is something that I wish every player could experience, playing for one of those clubs and being a part of that series, because it makes you raises your level of play, and it holds you accountable to you as a professional athlete. And it makes you a better teammate and player. It really does. I remember, Buster, I was in that series in September, and I came in to run, and Mariano was pitching, And I remember Jorge Posada went out to the mound after I got to first base, and then he went back behind the plate after the mound visit. And then Mo came set, and he held and held and held, and then he delivered a pitch. And then the next pitch, I stole a base, and then I think Orlando Cabrera got a base hit in extra innings, or the top half of the 10th, I think it was, and because it was in Yankee Stadium. And then we won that game. And then so I just told myself, if I ever get in that situation where Mo's on the mound and I'm at first base, he's going to try to hold the baseball to kind of deter me from stealing. So that's something I will always I always remembered. And then going back to that Angel series, Frankie Rodriguez, K-Rod, was pitching in that one appearance that I made in the DS. And I was so mad at myself because I had a chance to steal and I didn't go for fear of getting thrown out. And we ended up winning the game. But I said, if I ever get that opportunity in my role, I'm ready, I'm prepared, I'm not going to let that opportunity pass. So now you layer on my frustration with myself with Frankie in Angel Stadium, and then my information in September with Mo and Jorge, that kind of went on to game four.
And so that must have been unusual for you in that Angel series to feel that way after it was over, because, Dave, you had that great base runner's arrogance. You know, you see it in a guy like Billy Hamilton now, where, you know, I remember talking to Billy Hamilton when he was a minor leaguer. He stole six bases in one game. I asked him, how many times you go on the first pitch? He goes, every time. That's the sort of mentality that you had as a base stealer.
It is, Buster. And I think that it's one of those things that my favorite player growing up was Ricky Henderson. And I can see Ricky, you know, he does his walk or, you know, gets a base hit. And he was doing everything he could to get everyone in that ballpark to watch him at first base and saying, this is now the party is really going to get started. You know, and I want all eyes on me. And so I kind of took that mentality, you know, when you get on first base, you get out there before the pitcher gets set. He stared you down, you make him step off, and then you don't move, you don't bat an eye, and you just want to add that pressure, and it's just that gamesmanship type thing. And so, yeah, and that year, I think, you know, my percentage was really high in 2004. I don't recall what it was for
38 for 41. You know. You were 38 for
okay,
41
there you go.
Before
well,
that
thank
game.
You. Thank you, Buster.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I was pretty successful, so I just, That moment right there, I guess, to be honest, was just too big for me in that DS. And then I was just so mad at myself because I just felt that at that point, no one was better at stealing a base than I was. And I guess I backed down from the challenge at that point in time. And so I just said, like I said, if I ever get that chance, there's no one better than me and I'm prepared and do it. And I think that then it goes into the whole, how are you going to stay prepared? Because Buster, if you look at my game log, from the end of the season through the DS and you know, you're leading up to game four with the off days, I didn't play a lot at all. And so now you're talking about how do you keep your mind sharp, your body sharp. And Lynn Jones was my first base coach, So we used to work on jumps and leave during batting practice and, you know, watching video with our video coordinator, Billy Broadband, and all that stuff kind of happened. And I'm telling you, it's like Johnny struggled in the DS, Mark Bellhorn struggled in the DS, and it was more like me being a great teammate and a great friend at that point in time, pumping them up and telling them how much we're going to need those guys in the potential CS or the World Series and being a cheerleader, and that was my role, but still being ready if called upon. And I know I'm getting ahead of myself, and we'll go back to game four, but I didn't have an inning or an appearance in the World Series. And it's like, yeah, I look back and I go, and it's disappointing, but I just kind of look at it. And Tito was very good as far as keeping me in the loop and saying, hey, no game in the World Series really, Matt, was close enough where we could have used you, you know, in a plus or minus one run game or a tie ball game late. That's when we need you. And he didn't want to burn me. And so I felt value in that. But obviously, man, you get to the World Series, you want to take an at bat, and I didn't get that opportunity, but I still was a part of that World Championship team. And I know that my teammates, coaches, fans felt my value, and that's all I needed. And I just love playing for the Red Sox.
Yeah, and that was one of the questions I was going to ask you about, not playing the World Series. So you check that box for me. All right, you guys lose game one, you lose game two, you lose game three, and you're losing game four. What happened in the first part of that series after that great regular season?
Yeah, we just basically, I think that we got hit in the mouth, and I think game two might have been close. And I haven't, you know, even me managing now, I don't go back and look at these games in the postseason, the ones we win, the ones we've lost. And even in that series, Buster, I haven't gone back and looked. I really haven't. So I think that game two was close. I do recall we got routed in game three. And it was goes back to that whole idiot mindset. You know, you get it, you know, one of the leaders, Kevin Millar, and his bleach blonde hair and the big old goatee and, you know, Californian turned country, you know, guy, you know, just telling us not to panic and to win one game. And it just kind of, we bought into it. And it was like that whole mindset. And now everything around us, the expectations, you guys are letting us down again. You know, I remember going into a sushi restaurant with my family and middle-aged man says, the Red Sox got my grandfather. They got my father, and now you guys are coming after me. And it's just that's what we were living with in New England, you know, and here we go again. We're going to disappoint again. And we just drowned that out and kind of flipped the script and made light of some things and not taking things too seriously. But, you know, Buster, in that clubhouse, it was 25 very focused guys along with the coaches and the staff that were you know, focus on winning that series still.
So I hope that when that fan said that to you, he had a smile on his face, or was he dead serious?
Oh, he was dead serious. Absolutely. Oh, gosh. I mean, hey, you know those Bostonians, man. That wasn't – that's certainly not a time to joke when you're talking about late October and this October disappointments.
Yeah. Well, you guys are losing 4-3. It's the bottom of the ninth inning. And Kevin Millar leads off. Mariano Rivera's on the mound. And remarkably, you know, of course, Mariano's in the Hall of Fame, partly because he had such phenomenal control. He was not close in pitching to Kevin Millar. And during that at bat, as Millar's drawing a walk, the cameras on the video that I just watched today showed you turning and looking in the dugout to someone. And I'm guessing it was toward Tito or maybe down at that end of the dugout. And you were nodding like, okay. What's going through your mind as you're watching Millar's at bat?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you this is that once I got over there, we knew that if Mo was in, we still have a chance to win. And I don't think anyone can say that about Mariano Rivera or any great closer. And Kevin put on a great at bat. And so once he earned that walk, which was huge. Yeah, I was looking down at the end of the dugout. And I had just got done kind of doing my sprints in the clubhouse and in that plank laced hallway that, you know, going up to that old clubhouse at Fenway.
Yep.
And it's freezing cold. And I'm looking at Tito and I'm waiting for him to give me the go ahead. So it's that kind of famous wink. So he gave me that wink, you know, with that. All right, kid, it's all yours. And so I took the field and, you know, gave Kevin the tap on the shoulder and it was on. So, yeah, and then I remember Dale Swaim puts on the bunt sign with Billy Miller, and I remember at that moment in time, I'm telling Lynn Jones, no, I'm going to steal this base. So have them take the bunt sign off, and so Tito obliges, takes off the bunt sign, Swaim takes off the bunt sign, and Lynn whispers in my ear, he goes, Okay, kid, do what you do. And so that, for me, I give Tito all the credit for not just playing it safe and putting the bun on, but letting me do my craft and try to steal a base and try to drive that run in with Billy, a former batting champion. And so that's one thing I really recall.
Yeah, and Tito told me that his thought was is that if you didn't steal a base, then he was going to bunt with Bill Miller. But he gives you that chance because I saw you on the TV feed kind of roll your fingers in a circle, like go through that again. And then you could tell that something was going on there. You go out first base, you get a huge lead and he makes three throws to first base. The third one was relatively close, but I got the feeling from reading your body language, like I got this, that's the way you were feeling in that moment. How come?
You're exactly right. And it's one of those things that we've all watched Top Gun. And, you know, when Goose or Maverick gets a radar lock on those MiGs, they got him. And for me, once he threw over once, I felt that I was kind of locking him in. And my legs were kind of still tight and nerves were going through my mind. And then I had a big lead. And then he threw over the second time. And then all the nerves started to dissipate. And then once he threw over the third time, I had him on lock. And I had him locked in. And that's where it was like, I knew it was close, but there was a little smirk. And it's me knowing that the body language that I'm trying to exude to, I think it was Zim over there and Joe Torre, is like, I'm nervous. They got me. It's too close. And I'm trying to lay in the weeds. But I knew that once he delivers that baseball to home, I got him. And so I had a big lead because of the tutelage from Maury Wills, who always told me to get my maximum lead. And like I've told you before, Buster, he said that one day you're going to have a chance to steal an important base. And everyone in the ballpark knows you're going to steal. And you can't be afraid. And you're going to steal that base. And that's on the backfield of Vero Beach. And so now you fast forward to game four. I'm there. I got him on radar lock. And then it goes back to September where he's going to hold.
Yep.
And so I had to tell myself to keep that soft focus in my eyes. And so I'm looking at the middle of his body, keeping the soft focus. I'm just holding. I'm holding. I'm holding. I'm just waiting him out, waiting him out, waiting him out. And then once he delivers that baseball, I had a great jump. And it's one of those things where as a guy, when you hit a homer, you know when you hit a homer for the most part. And when you get a great jump as a base dealer, you know you got him. And so I got that great jump and I didn't realize the pop time. I mean, it was like a 1.7. Brad Mills said it was the fastest pop time he'd seen all year. And Jorge made a tremendous throw, Derek with the tag. And I didn't realize how close that play was. I really didn't. And so the Cowboy, Joe West, was right in position, got it right. And it's funny, Buster, I always joke that as time goes on, when I do see that particular play, it looks closer and closer. So hopefully at some point in time, I don't get called out and Joe doesn't reverse his call.
That's awesome. You were mentioning about Mariano holding the ball. As you told me that back from September, I remember watching a sequence today. He held the ball in the third one, and then he threw to first base. And then my guess is at that point as a base runner, you're thinking there's no way he's thrown here again. He's already thrown over three times. He's held the ball. He's varied his times. He's going to go home.
That's right. That's right. And it's funny is that most of the times it's after twice, the third time you feel like you have a chance, but whether it's Zim or Joe calling for that third throw over, I thought was really, really smart. But like I said, once he threw over the third time, it just seemed like I had played baseball every day for the last 2 weeks and I hadn't missed a beat. I played nine innings that night. And so I was just into the flow. Nerves dissipated. Like I said, I had him on radar lock and then got the great jump. And then the first thing Derek, well, after he tagged me, goes, how the F did you just do that? And so he was just pretty impressed. So that was kind of cool for Derek to say that. And it didn't take long for Billy to drive me in.
Yeah. And it's interesting. And again, and watching it after you steal the base, you give the big pump of the fist down to the ground. You're fired up. Bill Miller's in the box with a runner at second base. And then the next pitch, he squared. And I asked Tito in the text, I'm like, was there any thought that he was going to bunt? He goes, no, he said, Bill Miller doesn't get enough credit for how good that at bat was because he had so much going on and he winds up getting the big hit. What was your read of his at bat?
That's the thing is that, yeah, I mean, that's why it's like this team, yes, we won a World Series, but there's so many things that have to happen to win a World Series. And whether it's Kevin's walk or Bill Miller to be able to take a pitch and to square to now, those are little things that get lost in the subtleties of the game where you square, you pull it back to try to buy the base runner a little bit more time to potentially be safe. And now to square up a pitch and, you know, you got to use the middle of the field to try to get me over. He squares it up and drives up the middle. And it's like, those are things that can't be underappreciated. Absolutely.
So as you're rounding third base after Bill hit that ball into center field, and Bernie Williams did not have a good throwing arm, did you know as soon as you saw it, boom, I'm home?
I did not. I mean, I would think that, but I just think that the only thing I was thinking about was running as fast as I could and cutting that corner of the base as sharp as I could. And it was one of those things that, yeah, I slide. I had obviously didn't need to slide, but just the emotion of just, I'm going to get there and there and however I can get there as quick as I can. And you just felt that kind of spark, that relief, and I'm kind of coming to the on-deck circle into our visiting, into our home dugout and, you know, yelling, let's go. And everyone just kind of excited, relieved. And it was just something that Red Sox Nation, we just needed right there. And obviously, I played Buster with so many great players, and I was just a blip on the map. But it's like that play that people kind of look to as a turning of the tides. And I'm just very humbled to be a part of that entire whole deal, that whole organization.
Yeah, you tie the game. David Ortiz blasts a home run to walk it off in the bottom of the 12th. The next night, you pinch run, and you're part of a comeback. You're down 4-2 in the bottom of the 8th, and you scored on a sacrifice fly. You win again in the 14th. David Ortiz, the hero again. Real quick, what was he like? Why was he so special in the postseason, having gotten to know him as a teammate?
You know what? He just could calm things down. And I think that when everything gets ramped up and you start squeezing the bat more, and you see it all the time in big games where guys go out of the strike zone, pitchers try to overthrow, try to be too perfect. They make mistakes, but then the best ones can kind of slow the game down. And you talk about Michael Jordan, you talk about David Ortiz, you know, all the great ones, Tom Brady, you know, and things like that. So David just had this ability to just slow the game down, get a good pitch to hit and put a good at bat together. And you talk about that walk-off homer. That's Paul Quantrill who threw that hit ball that it was a great at bat. He throws that hit ball in, and that if you ever stand in the box and you see a ball coming at you and it runs back on the plate, I mean, he froze many guys at that pitch, many left-handed hitters. And for him to stay inside that ball, keep it fair, is ridiculous. And then that next night you're talking about where I think Flash Gordon gave up the save.
Yep.
David has this like 10, 12, 13 pitch at bat versus Loaiza, and he's throwing everything but the kitchen sink at him, and he just gets sawed off on a cutter, I think it was, and he just has the baseball to, you know, softly line it to center field, I think, and to win the game there. It's like those hits, and then not to mention, you know, the night before he goes Oppo Taco to tie the game. I mean, it's just amazing. I just never seen anyone take such good at-bats and get bigger hits than he did in that whole series.
So with that great competitive mentality, when do you think that the 2004 Red Sox knew they were going to win that series? When was sort of the moment where, like, we got these guys? We're going to be the worst team in history to come back from a 3-0 deficit.
I think once – so we win game four, game five, and then so 1-2 in New York, 3-4-5 in Boston, and then we go to New York. And so six was a tough one because we felt that, you know, we're still down 3-2, and we're going back to their place. And this is the whole mindset of winning one game. But this is where an hour before the game, we didn't know who was going to start. And so it's like, I don't know if Schilling's going to start. I don't know if it's a patchwork 10-day. I mean, no one knows. I mean, everyone's kind of like, we're going to play this game. You know, we got doctors in there and Schill's limping around. He's in the trainer's room and we don't know if he can even go and so we felt good about things, but, you know, if you don't have a starter, you don't feel as great. So I don't think that there's a person that felt like, you know what, we're going to – I mean, I was comfortable, confident, but until we got through that game, then it's like once we got through that game and Schill was kind of going out there and doing his thing, I knew that the series was ours. And you could just see it from the beginning. After we won game six and game seven, those guys didn't stand a chance.
Yeah, Schilling goes seven innings in the Bloody Sox game, allowing one run. And you guys come back, as they say, the first team in baseball history to come back from a 3-0 deficit. The next spring, when Mariano Rivera, and you, of course, had been traded by that point, Mariano Rivera was still in the Yankees. On opening day, he's introduced at Fenway Park, and he got a standing ovation, a huge roar. And Mariano lifts his cap, tips the cap to the crowd with a big smile on his face. And after that, he was always someone who I think was appreciated, respected in Fenway Park after what happened in the playoffs the year before. Did you ever get a chance to talk to him? Did you ever bump into him and talk about that sequence?
So I think the following year, we did a campaign for Macy's, maybe. And we were in Miami, I think it was. And we kind of crossed over and we talked a little bit, but not about that. And then I think I saw Mo a couple years ago and we kind of recapped it a little bit. But we haven't gone into total detail. And I just obviously have just, you know, respect what he did, you know, on and off the field, but we really didn't go into it. I did talk to Derek 1 year after, and he's like, I told those guys we should have thrown over four times and then we would have got you. And I just kind of smiled and laughed. So we've had a little bit of back and forth about it. But I haven't really talked to Mo about it. But it's funny is that going back to your thing about when we knew it, but if you look back at that series, Buster, it's like there are certain things that in Yankees Red Sox series in the past, whether it be a Tony Clark ball that was a ground rule double in game four that would have hit the wall and Derek would have scored from first, or a home run that Bellhorn hit that was called a foul or whatever, but then they called it a home run. Or there are certain things that happen, whether it's the Alex thing with the Arroyo thing that they got the call right, where in that situation, you know, that could have changed that game. So there's a lot of things that kind of flipped that went our way, which in years past, you know, I've learned that it always went the Yankees' way. So those are other things just to kind of recap that.
Yeah. Oh, without a doubt. And the year before, of course, was when they came back against Pedro.
Right.
Grady's little last year's manager. Last one for you. Your championship ring. Do you ever wear it now?
I don't wear it now. When I do go back to Boston for different events, I will bring it. It's in a safe in my house. I definitely look back with such fondness, but I don't wear the ring. I went back the following year for the ring ceremony, and I actually just signed with the Padres that winter, and that's something that I'm forever indebted to Theo about, because I was going to come back as a fourth outfielder. They were going to pay me an above kind of what the fourth outfielder was going to pay just to keep me there as a luxury. And I pleaded to Theo that I wanted to go somewhere and play as I was kind of in the middle of my career, and I wanted to be an everyday player. And so he and Kevin Towers, the late Kevin Towers, a good friend of mine, worked out a deal and got me to San Diego. So that's something I will always be grateful for to Theo and Jet. But I went back to the ring ceremony. I think it was, you know, their first home game in 2005. And just seeing my old teammates, and we had a good group come back. And it was the best just to put that uniform on one more time.
Yeah. And tell me about what it was like to be introduced.
You know, they say I got a great ovation. It was just one of those things that it was a perfect day. I know I was received very well, and I just wanted to just show my sincere gratitude for, you know, the Red Sox fans and Red Sox Nation. They welcomed me, Buster, my family. My daughter was born at Brigham and Women's, and it's just like the whole Red Sox family just really welcomed us. And so just to be there received and to get my ring from Mr. Henry and Mr. Werner, you know, Larry and all those guys, it was really, really cool.
Dave, that's awesome. I appreciate you digging into it and going to the memory bank for us.
Yeah, I don't do it very often, but for you, anytime.
Numbers game.
Sarah Lang's a reporter and a producer for MLB.com. And Sarah, as I was having that conversation with Dave, I knew that I wanted to ask you about that stolen base and trying to put it into history. The more that I thought about it, I wonder if it's the most important, most pivotal stolen base in the history of baseball. What do you think?
I think it absolutely has to be. I mean, just in terms of what it did, not just for the game, for the series, but I mean, maybe it's too overdramatic, but it feels like it changed the course of baseball history. And we could be talking about the Red Sox, you know, still not having won, if not for that one singular moment. And I think that there are not as many stolen bases that you can really think of that changed so much in one, you know, quick instance, a couple seconds like that.
Yeah, that's why it occurred to me to have you on, because as I was going through it, I'm like, I must be forgetting some, because it didn't feel like there were a lot of examples of stolen bases that were pivotal. You know, one that jumped to mind, for example, what was it? The 26 World Series ended with Babe Ruth being thrown out at second base.
Yeah.
You know, we certainly have seen, you know, record setting stolen bases. Ricky Henderson pops to mind. How would you rank the greatest stolen bases?
Okay, so here's my list. And, you know, the thing is, it's very hard to isolate. And you know how I look stuff up, right? I look on Baseball Reference. I go through what I know, what I've learned from documentaries and reading and all of that. And it's very hard to isolate the exact momentum or, you know, not win probability added, but that too, or anything like that to one specific stolen base. They aren't searchable by that one event, because that was my go-to. When you asked me that, I was like, okay, I'm going to find the most pivotal stolen base by numbers. And it didn't exist because it's not actually a search you can do. So I went to other things. I have Dave Roberts, number one. I have Ricky Henderson's record breaker, 939, number two, because again, I mean, I'm thinking sort of from the history standpoint. When I think of greatest, I'm thinking about, you know, changed a record book, changed something that everyone will know forever. And of course, you know, him picking up the base, the whole moment, I think that that's just so etched into all baseball fans' minds. And then number three, and I thought about this for a very long time between my number three and what would be my number four. I have Jackie Robinson in the World Series stealing home. I know they didn't win that game. They did go on to win the series, but I just think that that might be one of the most iconic moments in baseball history. Take away stolen base specifically or anything else like that. I think that a lot of people know that moment. I think that it's really important for the legend and history of Jackie Robinson, and that's why I went with it, number three.
Yeah, and I know Yogi Berra would disagree with you, because
yes.
I have talked to Yogi, of course, about that play. He talked to many people about that play, and he always, with a small smile, would always say, Jackie was out. And I got to tell you, looking at the replay of it, I've always agreed with Yogi on that
yeah.
He was out. Home plate umpire Bill Summers was in the worst possible position to make that call. He looks like he's about 4 feet behind Yogi. There's no way he could see that whether he's safe or out. What do you think?
Yeah. I mean, yes, looking at that and looking at the photos, I do see that. But I think that's part of why I have it here, too, is there are so many moments. I mean, we talk about this with instant replay and so many other things. There are so many moments that are a moment in baseball history because maybe they shouldn't have been, or because maybe there is more to the story, even though whatever is in the box score. And I don't know. I'm such a sucker for those kinds of moments. I love that. You know, that's part of what makes the sport so exciting and great.
I agree with you on number one. On number two, I don't agree with you on Jackie Robinson, number three. And
yeah.
For the reason you said, they didn't win the game. In fact, I can imagine if that happened in the modern era, Jackie Robinson would have been blasted because they were down 6-3 in the eighth inning. He's stealing home plate down 6-3 in the eighth inning, Sarah.
Yeah, no, it's not great. I know that. That is certainly for sure. So what did you have, number three?
I've got Maury Wills, 1962, okay. Breaking Ty Cobb's record. It was a record, I think, that had stood for 47 years, and he finished that year with 104 steals. So that's where I would have it, three. Yeah, yeah. Fair?
Yeah, definitely fair. Can I tell what my number four was? Because
okay.
I didn't know much about this stolen base, I'll say, before I started doing some research last night. So Reggie Jackson stealing
yes.
home in 1972 ALCS Game 5, and the decisive game is 1-0. They're trailing. They pull off a double steal on a strikeout. He steals home. He hurts his hamstring. He misses the whole rest of the postseason, but it's kind of the beginning of, you know, being Mr. October. And, you know, obviously they go on to win the series. In that game, they go on to win the World Series. And I watched this and I read a lot about it. And I think I knew about it, but I certainly didn't know quite how pivotal a moment it was in a 1-0 game to tie the game and all of that.
Yep. That's a great one. And in fact, I even wonder if that's should be ahead of Mari Wills on the list. So, yeah, fascinating conversation. What a great conversation we have with Dave Roberts. Sarah, thanks for doing this.
Thanks so much for having me, Buster.
So, Taylor, I mentioned to you that I got a text message from Theo Epstein after we did the Dave Roberts interview, and I asked Theo about what he remembers about the details of that trade for Dave, given how important that acquisition turned out to be. His text is, so we were in the middle of Nomar madness. In other words, that's when the Cubs or the Red Sox were talking about dealing Nomar Garciaparra, working the four-team negotiation, trying to decide whether to pull the trigger on a trade of such importance. Meanwhile, we had made an internal vow that we were always going to be thorough in our pursuit of a piece that could help us win one game down the stretch. And that meant looking for a speed guy to be a base running threat. And he mentioned a couple other players that they had acquired before. He wrote that on the 29th or so, I asked Zach Scott, the current assistant general manager, and at the time an assistant in the newly formed analytics department, to put together a list of the best potentially available plus base dealers. Guys who could steal a base even when it was obvious they were going. Dave was on the top of the list, but the Dodgers told us they would only move him if they were able to acquire another outfielder they were pursuing. Well, with the Nomar stuff hitting the fan as the deadline ticked closer the afternoon of the 31st, we saw the Dodgers traded for Steve Finley. We called a few minutes before the deadline, just minutes before the deadline, and they said they'd move Dave because they were worried about not having a role for him. They gave us four names, and one of them was a guy we basically considered a non-prospect, Henry Stanley, then a Pawtucket Red Sox outfielder and now a player agent. We made the deal one for one a few minutes before the deadline, right before the Nomar madness hit hyperspeed. How about that? Like right before the deadline, they put together that trade.
And one of those sliding door moments and historic at that. I mean, that's crazy.
Yep, absolutely.
Bleacher Tweets.
All right, Buster. Bleacher Tweets for Monday over here. The days blurring together, but we press on. Go Cubs Go 2020 at Kyle_Benning writes in, if you could pair any two World Series champs from the past decade to square off against each other in an epic clash of champions, regardless if they were from the same league, who would you pick? Any others outside of this decade, too, that come to mind?
Oh, yeah. Well, I think I'd love to put, you know, 98 Yankees against the 27 Yankees. That would be a fun matchup. Or the 55 Brooklyn Dodgers against the 98 Yankees. The 76 Reds, you know, one of the greatest teams of all time. But in the last decade, I'd go Madison Bumgarner's Giants of 2014 against the 2018 Red Sox, who won 119 games, because it felt like that with Madison Bumgarner on the Giants, they weren't going to lose. Like, he just refused to lose in the games that he pitched, and he was so dominant. That would have been fun to see a team as good as the Red Sox going up against a pitcher as red hot as Bumgarner was in 2014.
Greg Schoenbachler at Greg 603 writes in 1995, it can be argued that the Mariners had the best pitcher, the unit hitter, Edgar, and best all-around player, Junior, on one team. It's a tragedy they never made the series. Are there other teams that can make such a claim?
Oh, boy. Not to that degree. When you're talking about all-time great players, it is surprising that they didn't wind up making it to the postseason. Now, and after Griffey was gone, after Randy Johnson was gone, after Edgar, I think at that point he was gone too. In 2001, they won 116 games, and they wound up losing to the Yankees in the American League Championship Series. This after 9/11, and Lou Piniella, the Mariners manager at the time, basically said, look, that's what it was meant to be at this time. And he felt it was important for the Yankees to advance the World Series given world events.
Last tweet for today, Sterling at StirRide73 writes in, with Aaron Judge's run of injuries recently, do you see the Yankees being reluctant to lock him up to an extension in the near future, similar to how many of Judge's peers have signed long-term extensions?
Sterling, I don't think there's an extension on the horizon, but I don't think it's necessarily related to Judge's injuries. I've talked to agents and to club executives about this. The idea of trying to place valuations on players now, given current events, is just about impossible. because we don't know how much revenues there's going to be. You don't know what the impact of all this and the economic slowdown is going to be on Major League Baseball. I suspect that right now teams would absolutely at this point just lock their money in a vault and just wait until we see exactly what's going to come out the other end. So while there, you know, you could understand why there might be a discussion with Judge about a long-term deal, I don't think anybody has any idea what value is going to be on these contracts moving forward.
And that is Bleacher Tweets for Monday. As a reminder, we had David Wells and David Freese on last week. They were both excellent interviews. Yankees fans were going wild for the David Wells interview. And, you know, I know you folks have time on your hands. I know that we do. So if you, you know, have a free moment, you know, maybe drop in a nice review on iTunes or on Spotify. It all is super helpful. And one more thing before we get out of here, Buster, I wanted to mention to you, I watched the 04 Red Sox 30 for 30 last week in preparation for our David Roberts interview. And I wanted to note to the listener, it surprised me a little bit, although I guess I shouldn't have been surprised. Your voice shows up in that documentary. There's a montage before Curt Schilling goes out there to pitch. There's everyone saying, you know, he's not healthy. The Yankees are winning tonight. And you are one of the voices saying, I got to take the Yankees tonight. And it just made me chuckle as I was watching along.
Yeah, because at that point, no team had ever come back from a 3-0 deficit in baseball history. So, of course, we were all thinking the Yankees were going to pull it off. But as Dave Roberts said, I mean, there was even doubt in the Red Sox clubhouse about whether or not Schill was going to pitch an hour before the game.
Mm-hmm. Pretty wild stuff.
Yep, absolutely. My thanks today to Dave Roberts, to Sarah Langs, and to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.